I'm Henry St. John from the US Rate Strategy Team, and you're listening to At Any Rate, our global research podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries in markets today. I'm joined today by the head of US interest rate derivative strategy, Josh Younger, to talk about last week's supervisory changes to SLR and the implications for derivatives markets. So Josh, just to begin, what exactly did the Fed do last week?
Yeah, so they put out an interim final rulemaking, which puts forward a proposal for changes to bank regulation, in this case, specifically leverage calculations. So the idea here is to, at least as they propose it, exclude on-balance sheet treasuries and deposits at Federal Reserve banks from inclusion in leverage calculations for the purposes of things like the supplementary leverage ratio. Basically, long story short, when you think about your size as an institution for the purposes of that particular regulation, previously, essentially all assets were included, and the proposal is to exclude cash and treasuries from that calculation for a period of 1 year. So not on a permanent basis, but for roughly a period of a year.
So we wrote just a few weeks ago about some of the other Fed interventions that have come through and you know, some of the constraints that the banks were still facing. Why exactly did the Fed make this move?
So the Fed is very squarely focused on financial intermediation. This is clear from their direct intervention in markets, providing repos of essentially unlimited size, at least from a practical perspective, permanent open market operations, a variety of facilities designed to provide funding to dealers and to be an end buyer of securities. So the point of this whole exercise is to remove the constraints on market making as a driver of other forms of stress. And so what they're really trying to do in this case, by looking at the supervisory side, we think is to say at some point, the Fed's not going to be directly involved anymore. They've already downsized their permanent open market operations, their long-term asset purchases. And the idea is to allow banks, at least on a temporary basis, to step in and fill the gap, because the relief that they're describing being temporary, you know, expiring at the end of next year, that suggests that this isn't about long-term bank asset allocations, although it can affect that to some extent. It's really about providing incremental leverage to the system from banks to fill the gap when the Fed eventually steps back from the market.
Okay, so then I suppose the natural next question is this action enough? Is it enough to be loosening the constraints simply on leverage, or are there other areas where it needs to be loosened as well?
So it's an important part of the process. I mean, this is one of the things we highlighted a little while ago. On the one hand, it avoids the potential for a delevering cycle to accelerate because as credit facilities are drawn, this potentially presents banks with a leverage problem. But what's nice about this action is it really reduces the risk of that. But to really get at the core of the financial intermediation goals of this exercise, which again seems to be the Fed's stated policy goal in all of their actions, we think repo is a really big part of that just because it's the lion's share of the exposure. Another bit that's been raised is that many of the money center banks are not necessarily leverage constrained. They're more tier one capital constrained or TLAC constrained or something like that. But something to keep in mind is this is essential because as the Fed expands its balance sheet, as the Treasury issues a ton of securities, it's very likely that leverage will become a binding constraint in the future. And so this isn't about necessarily the situation as of the most recent stressed ratios, which is last year. This is about the forward path for bank binding constraints, and leverage is almost certain to be one of those in the future. And it already is for the broker dealers who are a big part of this financial intermediation exercise. And so it's not necessarily enough on its own, but it really does highlight the kind of reform that would facilitate this easing of market stress as the Fed exits the market and allow banks to step in and fill its place. So I guess this sort of turned back to Henry. What else do they need to do? Is this part of a process? Is this kind of all we're likely to see? What do the next few weeks and months look like if the Fed is truly committed to this goal?
Yeah, so I suppose the first thing that needs to happen is this change needs to affect the entire holding company, and that means the banking subsidiary as well. And the reason is some of the leverage constraints that banks may well be facing is if they're facing draws on committed credit facilities, then those are previously off-balance sheet items that are then coming onto the balance sheet, creating some form of leverage constraint beyond where the sort of equity buffers give them some sort of cushion. And then on top of that, the sort of the organic balance sheet growth from the Fed's balance sheet from quantitative easing will also eventually sort of place pressure on leverage as well. So that needs to affect the banking entity and not just the broker-dealer, as you mentioned previously. The other sort of functionally binding constraint that many of the largest banks face is G-SIB. And so there is potential if, you know, we're looking at sort of ensuring that the interventions so far have the sort of best possible impact at ensuring that credit flows to businesses and households. It's about offering sort of potentially similar carve-outs to G-SIB. And so, you know, even just a pro forma translation into the G-SIB calculation, we know that Treasury holdings impact the score both in terms of size, but also in terms of complexity. So in size, it's just an aggregate balance sheet story. And then complexity, it's more via the trading securities and available for sale securities that sit on the dealer side of the balance sheet. Arguably, those two things are worth roughly the same amount of score pressure to most of the G-SIB. So there's the potential for a relief to come via that channel as well. And so I suppose just turning back to you, Josh, for one final question, assuming all this does go through, what do you think this means for swap spreads, particularly at the long end?
So what's interesting about this, I think, actually, is that for the most part, it's priced into funding markets. We have GC trading low single digits most mornings and days. That's about as tight as you're going to get, even with a lot of leverage deployed via the banking system. And at this point, that's really about Fed intervention. So This regulatory relief is less about repricing funding spreads, especially in overnight markets, and it's more about sustaining the current level of very accommodative conditions for a longer period of time, after which the Fed has actually exited the market. So when we think about swap spreads, that's really a front-end story, not a surprise there. So it means a decent amount to 2 and possibly 3 year swap spreads, but in particular because the relief is temporary, it really is focused on the overnight markets and to some extent term repo markets. And so you're not going to see banks necessarily adding a lot of 3 to 5 year or even longer maturity treasury securities to their portfolio. And in that sense, it's less of a story for intermediate and longer end spreads, and it's more of a story for the front end. So when we think about the long end, especially the balance of flows and the long-term issuance forecast or even the medium-term issuance forecast, makes a much bigger difference. And when we think about the ledger there, the buyers and the sellers of duration, we come to the conclusion that one, at least on the end user side, the buyers of duration are outnumbered by the sellers of duration. And perhaps more importantly for spreads, the buyers of duration are preferentially in derivatives, specifically in LIBOR-linked swaps, and the sellers of duration are primarily in securities. So you have on the buyer side, the Fed, obviously, but you know, they're not necessarily going to be buying all of the treasury issuance that's going to come. And then you have the REITs potentially downsizing, and that means unwinding pay fixed hedges. You've got banks who, as we've noted a few times, are negatively convex and have to add duration preferentially in derivative format. You've got on the sell side, you've got the treasury, right? They're selling a lot of bonds. And you've got long-end investors like pensions who, in many cases, have rate hedges that have performed quite well. And the experience of 2008-09 suggests that they're likely to take profit on those positions, preferentially the synthetic exposures, but those are mostly treasury linked at this point anyways, and also potentially on the securities side. So the outlook for the long end, especially, is quite bearish. And you know, getting to a negative 60 basis point handle seems much more likely to us than staying at current levels. And most of that really is on the supply side and being quite bearish, and then on the demand side being relatively weak. So our outlook for spreads, all of that taken together, is really quite bearish. On the one hand, you have quite a few receivers of duration, not as many payers. And on the other, you got quite a few sellers of cash duration and not as many buyers. And so that's a setup for spreads going more negative in the long end and not staying positive for very long. In tens, there's only so much support funding market conditions, particularly overnight funding market conditions, or even term repo conditions. There's only so much support that can provide. So even if we get a really expansive regulatory intervention that's designed to facilitate market making and intermediation and is successful in doing so, that doesn't mean you can't have intermediates and long end spreads declining quite a bit.
Right. And thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2020, JP Morgan Chase & Co., all rights reserved. This episode was recorded on April 6th, 2020.